My name is Talia Smith, and you're listening to Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast. Enjoy! Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, I have an awesome guest, Siobhan Miller. Siobhan is a graduate of California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo, with a degree in history and minors in music and child development. She was most recently a teaching with primary sources intern at the Library of Congress, with yours truly, where she completed several projects creating teaching resources about women in the military and women Air Force service pilots during World War II. When not studying history, Siobhan enjoys reading, getting outside, and enjoying the arts. Welcome to the pod!
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have you on. As I kind of alluded to before, Siobhan and I met via our work at the Library of Congress.
That's right.
Very pretentious way of saying that. But I really wanted to have her on the podcast because of her passion for the WASPs, which we are going to be talking about today. This is going to be a really fun episode. And we're going to talk about some really important slash adventurous stories today. So thank you so much for sharing with us.
Yeah, I'm excited to get started.
Our story today is on the WASPs. Can you tell me what WASPs stands for?
Yeah, sure. I think we have kind of an association with WASPs. So I want to say that WASP stands for Women Air Force Service Pilots, WASP. So I'll refer to them as WASPs or WASP pilots or Women Air Force Service Pilots. Kind of, I'll use those interchangeably, but they all mean the same thing.
Perfect. And can you give me three fun facts about the WASPs?
Yeah. My first fun fact is about the director of the WASP program. Her name was Jacqueline Cochran, who you might have heard of. She was a pretty famous pilot at the time, but she was the first woman to break the sound barrier in May of 1953, just 6 years after Chuck Yeager did it. So Chuck Yeager did it in 1947. 6 years later, Jacqueline Cochran also broke that barrier, which was a huge deal. Jet engines had just been introduced at that time. And then the Women Air Force Service Pilots, probably you don't know about them. They're virtually unknown. After the program ended in 1944, they've been gaining a little bit of notoriety recently. Congress and President Barack Obama awarded the WASPs the Congressional Gold Medal. And then two WASP pilots, Dora Dougherty and Dorothea Moorman, are responsible for bringing the B-29 Superfortress into the war. So if you think about a bomber in World War II, you're probably thinking about the B-29 Superfortress. It's that really big four-engine shiny plane that I think we think about. But when it was first introduced, male pilots were really, really nervous about flying it. It was really big, really complex. And so two WASP pilots, Dorothea Moorman and Dora Dougherty, were recruited to be demo pilots, and they flew the plane by themselves. And once they saw that women could fly the plane, male pilots' hesitancy went away. They were basically like, oh, well, if women can do it, we could do it too. And the plane became widely used and a really essential aspect of American victory in World War II. And that was all due to women.
Wow. So really toxic masculinity pushed. That's incredible.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the thesis of your fun facts could really be summed up as, honestly, these women are just badasses who are also pioneers.
They were such badasses, honestly.
I feel like there are so many stories that you could get into with these women and the WASPs in general. But can you give me the elevator pitch for what today's story is going to be about?
Yeah, definitely. So the Women Air Force Service Pilots was a program that was created during World War II. It was a civilian branch of the Army Air Forces. That's a really important part of our story today. They served in essential flying positions at home here in the continental United States so that more male pilots could be sent to fight on the front lines. And WASP pilots are notable because they were the first women to fly military aircraft for the United States. So they really paved the way for the next generation of female pilots in the U.S.
It's really interesting to think that they're the first women to fly military aircraft, because women have flown airplanes but way before that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we all know Amelia Earhart. I think a lot of us know Bessie Coleman, who was the first African-American woman to gain a pilot's license in the U.S. I mean, women had definitely been in aviation for quite a while by this point. But military aviation was definitely seen as exclusively male. It was reserved for men. And so when women started entering military aviation, that was a really, really big deal.
Why this story now? I mean, you could say that, well, there's been women in the military for decades now, and a girl could be a pilot too. Why is it important to learn about the WASPs in the 2020s?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of it is that so many people don't know about them. I mean, you know, they were really instrumental in bringing women into aviation, bringing women into military aviation, but a lot of us don't know. I didn't know this story for a lot of my life. And so I think it's important to tell this story because it gives us a more complete understanding of the role of women in World War II. I think a lot of us think about women in World War II in a very specific way, and learning about the WASPs really increases our understanding of women in World War II, and especially the thousands of women, hundreds of thousands of women who served in the armed forces.
Before we get into the story, let's talk about, very briefly, what would you say some of the stereotypical portrayals of women during World War II are? So I guess another way to phrase the question is, who are some of the WASPs' contemporaries that we might have heard of?
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of us, when we think of women in World War II, we think of industrial workers. And that was a really, really important thing that women started doing during World War II, was taking over those industrial jobs, taking over some of the jobs that men were leaving as they, you know, went abroad. And so, you know, WASPs were definitely contemporary with these industrial workers. Women, you know, some women stayed at home on the domestic front. And I think the kind of socially acceptable job for women at that time was to stay at home and to, you know, kind of keep things moving at home while others, you know, went and worked in the war.
Right.
And then, you know, WASPs were definitely not the only women in the armed forces at this time. 350,000 women served in the military during World War II. And I think that's relatively unknown to us today. But yeah, every branch of the military had a women's auxiliary attached to it. I think most of us know the Women's Army Corps. That was part of the Army at the time. The WASPs were part of the Army Air Forces, which would later become the Air Force, a separate branch of the military. We had women in the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard. So WASPs were also part of that group as well.
Wow. Okay. This is so interesting. So I guess we should just jump into telling this story. And Siobhan, will you please begin by using my favorite phrase, once upon a time?
Sure. Once upon a time, two very important women created some women's pilot organizations that would become the Women Air Force Service Pilots. So in 1941, female pilot Nancy Harkness Love created a program called the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron.
Wow, that's a bit of a mouthful. Is there an acronym for that one too?
Oh, we have so many acronyms. This one's called the WAFS, W-A-F-S, Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron. Another kind of nickname for this group was the Originals, because they were the original women to fly military aircraft.
Oh, the OGs. Love to see it.
Yeah, the OGs. That's right. So Love recruited really highly skilled female pilots, so a lot of hours in the air, to ferry planes for the Army Air Forces. Ferrying planes meant that they transported them from the factories where they were put together to the bases that they were used at, or between different bases, where they might be shipped overseas or they might be used at those bases here in the U.S.
Okay.
And then at the same time, Jacqueline Cochran, who was already a record-breaking, world-famous female pilot. She created an organization called the Women's Flying Training Division, which also has an acronym, WFTD, or Woof Teddies.
Okay.
I don't know where that came from, but there we go. Which trained less experienced female pilots to fly military aircraft so that they could enter the WAFs. So it was more of a training program than it was an actual flying program. They both really appreciated and knew the importance of bringing women into the Army Air Forces during this time. So they were working both at the same time to kind of alert higher ups in the Army Air Forces that women could fly military aircraft too. And they definitely started working together more and more as their programs advanced.
Awesome. So eventually the programs advanced quite a bit and they merge. Can you talk a little about that merger?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 1943, the two programs came together under the Army Air Forces to become what we know as the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. So Cochrane was appointed as Director of Women Pilots for the Army Air Forces. So she was really the figurehead for the program. Love was appointed as Director of WASP Ferrying Operations, and she actually continued to fly during the war, whereas Cochrane was more of the administrative lead.
Okay.
And the program moved and was based at Avenger Field in Sweetwater, Texas. Sweetwater, Texas, fun fact, is known now for being the site of the world's largest rattlesnake roundup.
Whoa. So,
there we go. That's kind of gives us a sense of what Sweetwater is like. Definitely lots of snakes there.
If anyone listening is from Sweetwater, Texas, please let us know. I'd love to hear more about the rattlesnakes. Thank you.
I would, yeah. I've seen some pictures of this rattlesnake roundup. It looks incredible.
That's pretty funky. Okay.
Yeah. So women who were accepted into the program would come to Avenger Field and they would train for 6 months. And then they would be assigned to different bases throughout the U.S., and they would complete different jobs for the Army Air Forces.
Just thinking of having to learn and perfect, really perfect a skill in 6 months under really stressful conditions, I think is impressive for anything.
Yeah, yeah, it is really impressive. And know that, you know, all of these women were coming in, they at least had some training in flight before mm-hmm. they came in, but they had to learn the really specific type of flight that they needed for military aircraft. Military aircraft were bigger, they were faster, and they were a lot more complex than anything these women had seen before.
That's incredible. So how competitive was it to become a WASP?
It was really, really competitive. Over 25,000 women applied to the WASP program, which kind of gives us a sense of how many women knew about aviation or were involved in aviation at this time in the U.S. Yeah. But only 1,300 women, 1,300, were accepted for training. And of those, only 1,074 actually graduated the training and flew as WASP pilots for the Army Air Forces.
Do you know, like, common reasons as to why somebody might not have graduated the program?
Yeah, I mean, there are different reasons. A lot of them were they might have washed out of training, which means that they maybe didn't pass one of their check rides, which is when you're, you know, in a plane with an instructor and they're marking down different things that you need to be able to do. Or they might have left training due to a family emergency. Some women were married when they came in and maybe they needed to support their husbands or things like that. But it was a fairly low washout rate.
And do you know the demographics of women who were applying to become WASPs?
Yeah. The women who applied versus the women who got in is a bit of a different demographic. So remember that the entire military was still segregated at this time. And so even though African-American women did apply to the WASPs, and many of them were definitely qualified to come in, no African-American women entered the WASP program at all. And that was a conscious decision by Jacqueline Cochran. She decided to exclude African-American women because the WASP program was already an experimental program. And she thought that if she let in African-American women and they were integrated in, that might cause even more scrutiny than the program already had. Mm. That doesn't mean that women of color were not in the WASPs, but no African-American women were in the WASPs. So there are two known Chinese-American women, Maggie Gee and Hazel Ying Lee. Hazel Ying Lee was from Oregon. So that's an interesting tidbit, Pacific Northwest gal, just like me. And she was actually the 38th and final woman to die during WASP, during her service as a WASP. And she died in a mid-air collision that happened. And then we do know of one Native American woman. Her name was Ola Rexroat, and her nickname was Sexy Rexy, which I think is really fun. And then there were a couple of Latino women who were involved. Unfortunately, there's very little information available about them. But the demographic, if we think of, you know, those few women out of the thousand who served, definitely it was widely white, mostly middle class women. Because if we think about, you know, who had access to flight lessons at this time, they were expensive. Right. You had to be near an airfield. You know, you had to be supported by your family, all of those different things. So definitely it was largely white, largely middle class women who were involved in this.
Wow. I think that really emphasizes the importance of like talking about the intersectionality of all these historical events, right? Because
absolutely, yeah.
I think it's so important to contextualize these situations in their time and place. It was a stretch to have white women in, so it's really interesting to see how they navigated at that time, both race and gender.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I've really struggled with, you know, while researching them is, you know, struggling with who isn't pictured here and how do I deal with that as a researcher.
Was it difficult to find information on the women of color who served? I know you said that you couldn't find anything about some of the Latino women who served.
Yeah, I mean, research about the WASPs is pretty sparse anyways. It's not a super highly researched thing. A lot of what I found was either through, you know, Air Force research that happened, you know, quite a while ago, or different historians have kind of touched on this, but it's definitely the women of color in the WASP program are usually underrepresented in the research about the WASPs. And I think Hazel Ying Lee is talked about the most, and I think that's because, unfortunately, she lost her life. And so she's, I think, a bit more notable. I don't want to say it that way, but because she lost her life and because she was the 38th and final person to lose her life. But yeah, there's not a lot about the women who served. I know that Maggie Gee, she's from Oakland, California, and there is a petition in Oakland right now to rename the Oakland airport after her. And I don't know how that petition is doing. They're relatively well-known maybe in their home communities, but maybe not quite as much outside.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Well, I'm going to see if I can find that petition. And if I can find it, I will link it in our show notes if anyone is interested in learning more about that. And of course, with anything, we will have links to some of Siobhan's research and some other research done about the WASPs in our show notes. And we'll talk more about that later because there's a lot to cover. I find this to be mind-blowing. We have 1,300 WASP trainees.
That's right.
Yeah. What does that mean? What are they doing in the 6-month program?
The training was modeled almost verbatim after the male Army Air Force cadet training, with a little bit of an exception that WASPs were not trained for combat. So they didn't have some of the formation flying training and the gunnery training, things like that, that male cadets had. But they were subjected to the exact same discipline, the same schedule, the same standards as male pilots in the same training program. But they definitely were more than up to the challenge. WASP trainees were really effective in this program, and their washout rate, which we talked about a little bit earlier, which is, you know, if they can't pass the standards of the program, was actually less than the male pilots, just slightly, but a little bit less, which is pretty cool.
Rock on.
Yeah, right. And so their time was split between ground school and flight training. So they spent half their time in ground school. They learned Morse code, navigation, aerodynamics, physics, meteorology, a whole bunch of different skills. And that was in the classroom. And then they would go and they would do flight training. They did training during the day. They did acrobatics training. They did night flying, which you think about at the time, they didn't have any of the technology that we have today. So they had to rely a lot on, you know, the lights on the ground and things like that. I can't even imagine doing that.
I can't walk around my own apartment without putting on my little cell phone flashlight on.
That's right. I know. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, that's insane. When you say acrobatics, I assume you mean like aerial acrobatics of, right, of the planes, like those loop-de-loops that you see and like what you would see at air shows perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. So they did a lot of things like that. They needed to know how to right a plane if it got turned upside down for some reason. They needed to know what to do in an emergency.
Okay.
So they spent those 6 months in their program, and then after graduation, they could do a number of different jobs for the Army or Air Forces. So like we talked about before, a lot of them ferried planes, so they would transport them to different places throughout the United States. They weren't allowed to go abroad. That's a big thing. They didn't cross the Atlantic Ocean. They didn't cross the Pacific. They stayed within the United States. Others became flight instructors for male Air Force cadets, which I think is really interesting. And a lot of them said, you know, they didn't really experience a whole lot of discrimination. Every once in a while, someone would be kind of unhappy that they had a female flight instructor. But for the most part, they were pretty well respected as flight instructors. They helped with meteorological data gathering. So they would go up with maybe a scientist and gather data, which is really important for Air Force flight and for flight in general. They were test pilots for new planes, which is a super risky job. Or they performed the really risky task of towing targets for anti-aircraft gunnery cadets. So they would get a really long strip of fabric, they would put it behind their plane, and then they would go up and fly, and there would be people on the ground that would be shooting at them.
My gosh.
Yeah. And often they would use live rounds, not blanks. So there would be actual real bullets flying at these women as they were flying their plane back and forth in front of these cadets.
Well, my next question was going to be, how did those 38 WASPs lose their lives during the war if they weren't seeing actual combat? But I think I have an idea of how now, but can you go in?
Yeah. So that towing target, fortunately, the WASPs were pretty skilled and they ended up not getting too hurt during that part. But, you know, if you think about, aviation is still pretty new at this time. And it's still pretty risky, and especially military aviation, because they might be flying planes that were either old, maybe they had been in a fight before, or they were very new, and maybe they were just off the flight line, and, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So a lot of the accidents were due to mechanical failures, or they would be due to mid-air collisions. There were lots of planes flying around at this time, and air traffic control technology was not as good as it is today. So there was definitely a lot of mid-air collisions. And, you know, you listen to some personal narratives from WASPs, and a lot of them describe some near-miss accidents that happened where they were lucky to walk away from those. So, you know, it's almost surprising that only 38 lost their lives, because there was a lot of really risky stuff that these women were doing.
Wow. I think that's something, as I've learned more about aviation, study more about aviation history, I think it's almost something that's upsetting to learn about. The two most famous female pilots that we know of through history, both Bessie Coleman and Amelia Earhart, terribly tragic ends. So
yeah, exactly.
It is impressive now that you kind of put that into perspective, that really out of 1,000, only 38 passed is
yeah
pretty good.
Yeah, and I mean, those women definitely didn't get the same treatment as male Air Force pilots would get. And we can talk a little bit more about that later, because we'll talk about what was different about male Air Force cadets or Air Force pilots versus female.
Okay, I'm excited to learn more about the comparisons, because I think that will be really interesting, especially because they're like an auxiliary corps, so maybe a little bit different than your typical World War II fighter. But before we kind of shift over, would you say that the militaries, the generals, the higher-ups in World War II knew what was going on? Or obviously they knew what was going on, but were they generally supportive of this initiative, or were they kind of scoffing at this initiative?
Yeah, I mean, the most important man in the Army Air Forces during World War II was General Henry Arnold, or Henry Hap Arnold. And he was the director of the Army Air Forces during World War II. You've probably heard of him or seen a picture of him. And he was extremely supportive of the WASP program. He had worked with Jacqueline Cochran at the very beginning to get this started, and he was really, really pleased with the results. He was really pleased with their performance, the fact that they were doing better in their training than male AAF cadets.
To whose surprise?
So, I'm certainly not. And so, yeah, General Arnold was a really vocal supporter, both privately to, you know, his fellow generals and publicly. He spoke publicly about them. He testified before Congress about the real asset that he felt the women were to his organization. And I think, you know, going below General Arnold, there was mixed reception, but the most important man in the Army Air Forces was extremely supportive, and that is wonderful.
Well, I guess there are a few good men out there. That's awesome. It's 1944. You mentioned that General Arnold talked to Congress and spoke on their behalf. Can you tell me a little bit more about why and what that might be for, or any other efforts of the WASPs going to Congress?
Yeah, definitely. So when General Arnold was testifying before Congress, it was in favor of militarization. Okay. And what militarization means is that women pilots would officially be brought in to the Army Air Forces as enlisted personnel. And you'll recall from earlier that the WASPs were considered civilians throughout their time. So this is 1944, so about a year after the program was officially started.
Okay. And it would be a year, they wouldn't know this at the time, but that's a year before the end of the war in general.
Correct, yeah. So the war was still going on. It was definitely winding down, especially in terms of air power, but it was still definitely going on, and the United States was still feeling it, definitely. Yes. But the WASPs were still considered civilians, and that meant that they were subject to different treatment by Air Force officers. They were paid less than male pilots in the same position. Surprise, surprise, women were paid less than men. Sure. And they also, a big part of them being civilians, which meant that they were flying without insurance. So the insurance meant that if a person died, the Army Air Forces would pay to have their bodies shipped back to their families. They would pay some funeral expenses, things like that. So the WASPs who were flying without insurance meant that if they went through a tragic accident and they lost their life, as 38 did, their families would have to absorb all of the expenses of bringing their bodies back and having a proper funeral.
Oh, God.
So this is what they were kind of working towards. They were working towards being seen as enlisted personnel, getting all of the benefits that go along with that, including insurance, including payment, including proper treatment. And so Jacqueline Cochran was working really hard at this time and lobbying Congress to militarize the WASP program. So that's what that means when I say militarize. You know, we think of this as kind of common sense now. At the same time, I think the WASP saw it as common sense, because all of the other women who are serving in the military at this time. We talked about this a little bit earlier. You know, every branch of the military had women involved, were militarized at this time. So every other branch of the military, except for the WASPs, were not seen as civilians, but were seen as military personnel.
Oh, wow. So this wasn't something that they were maybe pioneering by themselves, like get women militarized. This is something that it almost seems they're uniquely excluded from when it comes to women in the military.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. But in 1944, when Cochrane was working for militarization, there was some complications and several challenges to her argument. And one of the biggest ones was that, as I said before, the war was winding down, and a lot of men were coming back from the front. A lot of male pilots were coming back from the front, and they were seeing that the jobs that they really wanted, which were safe, relatively, which were well paid for men, things like that, were being taken by women. And they really wanted those positions. They wanted those ferrying positions. They wanted those training positions that men or that women had at this time. And so at the same time that Jacqueline Cochran is lobbying Congress for militarization, male pilots start lobbying Congress to end the WASP program and bring men back into those positions that women were holding at the same time. So, yeah. And so a lot of the debate, if you read the congressional records from this time, a lot of the debate about WASP militarization, the bill that they have in Congress at the time, doesn't even really talk about the WASPs at all. It talks about the male pilots that were lobbying Congress and really had a strong lobbying force in Congress at this time.
My gosh, that is so interesting. And also, it's really poignant, I think, because maybe the technicalities are different in some of today's political debates. But the heart of that argument is something that we have to battle. Women have to battle. People of color have to battle. Members of other marginalized communities have to battle still to this day, where it's a blanket statement when, like, the white man can't get something that they don't even actually really want that bad, that they don't need, but somebody else has it. Who's going to get screwed over at the end of the day?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good point. And I think some of our debate too, you know, like the debates about WASP militarization, it kind of, you know, ignores whoever is actually important in the conversation and talks about maybe who doesn't have what they want. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Totally.
Oh, that's why studying history is so important. It's cyclical. Everything just happens over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think making those connections is one of the things that I really love about studying history. Seeing how things, you know, continue and how can we kind of edit that path? How can we make a change?
Right. Absolutely. I feel the same exact way. We're in 1944. We're in Congress. We're wrapping up these hearings. Mm-hmm. When it comes to a vote, I mean, I think we can kind of know what happens. We kind of led up to it. Yeah. But let's make it plain and simple. What happens to the WASPs?
Not only are the WASPs denied the militarization that they ask for, they're actually disbanded. They decide to end the program by the end of December 1944.
With the WASPs officially disbanded, they're not military personnel. We already covered the lack of insurance.
Right.
The war ends in 1945, basically like 8-ish months after this, 9-ish months after this decision was made. So what happens to these women? Where do they go? I mean, if they were regular soldiers, they would have the opportunity to go to college under the GI Bill. They would have had a couple of opportunities to advance in different ways. These opportunities aren't open to these women.
Right, exactly. So these women are sent home without any acknowledgement of their service. So these women are devastated. They have this amazing opportunity, and it ends just like that. unless the person at the base that they were at acknowledges that they served there, which several WASPs say, you know, they either were thanked by the general that were there or, you know, something like that. But other than that, they had no formal recognition of their service. And because, like you said, because they were considered civilians, they had no access to any of the veterans' benefits that exploded after the war. We think about the GI Bill. We think about all of the opportunities that that afforded young men at that time, going to college, buying their first house, starting a family. And the women of the WASP program were overlooked.
When did those women start to get acknowledged federally?
Not until 1977, 33 years after they served. President Jimmy Carter signed the GI Bill Improvement Act in 1977, which designated service in the WASP program as active duty military service, which meant that they could then access the veterans' benefits afforded by the GI Bill. And that was a really, really big deal for the WASPs. I mean, they had been staying active with each other during that 33-year period. They held regular reunions. They were lobbying Congress. They kept active and they kept fighting this fight for militarization, even after the fact, even after they were denied it. And it finally paid off in 1977 with that GI Bill Improvement Act.
Skip a couple of presidents.
Skip forward.
Who's the next president to acknowledge them?
So the next president to acknowledge them was President Obama. Congress and President Obama awarded the WASPs the Congressional Gold Medal, which was also a really big deal. And that signing ceremony, a lot of WASPs talk about that being a really big deal in their lives. And, you know, we think about World War II veterans. They were aging. Jacqueline Cochran and Nancy Harkness Love had both passed away by that point, unfortunately. But finally, these WASPs were really thanked for their service by Congress and by the president.
One of the exciting things that we got to do through our program, which you kind of organized, was going to Arlington National Cemetery to see some of the graves of some WASPs. So even though there were WASPs in Arlington for a while, can you tell me when the first WASP who made it into the cemetery on her own merit was buried at Arlington?
Yeah, it wasn't until 2016 that that happened. And that was also a really long fight. So a lot of WASPs were buried at Arlington National Cemetery before that. And that was due to the fact that they had husbands in the service. So if you don't know, Arlington National Cemetery, you can be buried with your spouse if they were in the military. And so the fact that it took that long for a WASP to be in, not because of her husband, but because of her own service, even though they were designated as active duty back in 1977, that's also really incredible.
Kind of from beginning to end, I'll say that kind of puts a wrap on the bare bones of the WASPs, but there's so much more to talk about.
Yeah.
How did you learn about the WASPs?
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting story. I had no idea the WASPs existed until high school. And I think, you know, Talia, you and I share a love of the arts and an interest of the arts. And I was a theater kid. And I was, as the best people are, I think.
As most of our guests are, let's be honest.
I'm in a good group. Yeah. But I actually did a play. I went to an all-girls high school. And so our theater director looked for, you know, plays that had all women casts. And this play called Decision Height by Meredith Dana Levy is about the women Air Force Service pilots. It follows six women through their training at Avenger Field. And I had no idea about the WASPs before this, even though I was a history buff. I loved history growing up. And so after I completed the show, I just became fascinated with their story. And I started researching more on my own. And then when I got to college and I started studying history, I researched more, you know, using those resources and wrote a couple of big papers about them, and then just it's continued from there. It's become my little passion project.
That's awesome. I learned about the wasps in the most Talia way possible. I very into the American Girls.
Yes.
And Molly McIntyre, the first doll from World War II. There's now two World War II dolls. She has an aunt who is a wasp. And in the movie, there's a little scene where she talks about her experience. It's very short, very really? Kind of snippy, but she's depicted as like this young, gung-ho woman who is a pilot and is moving out of her family home to train to be a wasp. So
that is so cool. I didn't know that before I met you. So isn't that cool that we like learn about them through these different kind of niche ways?
Also these very like girl power ways, like the American Girl and a full female cast theater production.
Yeah, we love the girl power. Yes. And I think, you know, that's one of the best ways to learn about these women history stories is doing some cool girl power things.
Definitely. Absolutely. And also, of course, our theme this season are stories of adventure. I feel like I've been saying this with every episode this season. However, it's pretty obvious why this is a story of adventure, wouldn't you say?
It
spark notes for me why you think this is an adventure story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty easy to make the connection, right, between aviation and adventure. And I think today we have a different view of aviation than they had in 1944 or 43. Where, you know, if you live in a big city, you probably see a plane a day, if not more than that. But then that was it was new technology, as we said. One of my favorite quotes from a wasp is she's talking about her first time going above the clouds during her wasp training. And the thing that she says is, I was thoroughly entranced. And I think just that kind of little sentence really brings it down to how this is a story of adventure. And these women were probably leaving their homes or their home state for the first time ever. All these women were pretty young. They were going to Sweetwater, Texas, out in the middle of nowhere, rattlesnakes, and starting this training and entering the military and doing all these things. And I think, you know, this real patriotic duty that a lot of these women felt was their catalyst for starting this adventure.
And you can learn more about some of the wasps through a variety of sources, definitely the Library of Congress. Where else can you learn more about the wasps?
Well, there's, if you're a documentary watcher, there's a PBS special about the wasps. It's called Fly Girls. They did it on American Experience quite a while ago. You can find that online. One of my favorite books is called Clipped Wings, The Rise and Fall of the Women Air Force Service Pilots by Molly Merriman. And so if you're interested in learning more, that's definitely a good spot to start.
Also, I want to mention that wasps have had their day in the spotlight a little bit. I mentioned Molly, the American Girl.
Yeah.
I went on Wikipedia just to see if there are other movies about wasps or other representation of wasps. And I found two superhero connections. I want to quote Wikipedia in this. So if this is wrong, don't at me, at Wikipedia. All right?
Yeah.
In the modern Wonder Woman continuity, Steve Trevor's mother, Diana Trevor, was a wasp who inadvertently crash-landed on Themyscira on a mission in the 1940s and died helping the Amazons fight an attacking menace. You can tell I'm a big comic book reader.
I had no idea.
Neither. And then in the 20s, this is also quoting from Wikipedia, all right? Disclosure. In the 2012 Captain Marvel story from Marvel Comics, Carol Danvers travels through time to 1943, where she fights alongside a squad of women Air Force service pilots on an island off the coast of Peru. So there you go, Captain Marvel and Wonder Woman. I also found on that article that there's a movie called Shadow in the Cloud. It was released in 2020 and stars Chloe Grace Moretz. I haven't seen it. I probably won't see it because it is described as an action horror film. My two least favorite genres. I don't know.
I was reading about it. It sounds really interesting. I don't know. Somebody watch it and like report back. But apparently there's a gremlin who's like running around the plane and like, you know, messing with things and trying to make the plane crash. And I'm like, what is this gremlin? I'm kind of curious, but yeah. I also don't know if I want to watch a horror movie, you know?
Yeah. I agree. There's a baby side plot, but like a demonic baby side plot. Really? I don't know. I'm not going to watch it, but if you want to, go for it.
Someone needs to report back though. We need to figure out what this movie's about.
Please do. The reviews are actually like not that bad. Like if That's you're into that good. Sort of thing. But Siobhan, you have dedicated so much time.
Yeah.
Into this project. And I really want people, especially teachers and educators, to learn about your work and to maybe utilize some of the things that you've done. So would you mind telling us a little bit about your research and how people can access your work? And of course, all of this will be linked in our show notes. But if you want to explain kind of what these sources are, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Yeah. So as part of my internship at the Library of Congress, I was creating teaching materials about the women Air Force service pilots and about women in the military in general. So I created some collections of primary sources. A primary source is something that is created at the time of a historical event. So there's photographs, newspaper articles, videos, etc., that are all kind of collected together so that an educator can either pick and choose what they'd like to share with their students, or they can go through all of them. And then there's also a small project-based learning activity that I created as well. So those are all available so that educators can introduce this story, because I think it really is an important way to understand World War II in a different way than I think we normally learn about it in a classroom.
And I can attest that Siobhan's resources are awesome. And just looking at, you know, the images of these women and, you know, the propaganda surrounding women in the military. And it's amazing.
It's fascinating. Yeah.
And also artistically stunning.
Yes. Like, yeah. There's some posters that are just like so fun to look at. There are lots of different posters that you can look at, you know, different ways of depicting women in the military or women in war work during this time. But there are some in my teaching resources that are just really cool and colorful and fun. Definitely a good way to introduce students or just look at yourself if you're interested.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the pod and sharing your research and for having a wonderful, lively discussion with me about World War II. I also want to say, this is going to make me sound, this whole episode is probably making me sound quite anti-men. And I don't know if I hate that representation of myself. However, you know, there's a distinct difference talking to women about World War II and talking to men about World War II. And I think this conversation is a testament to how there's quite a bit of a stereotype about World War II historians or World War II nerds, and how there is a larger breadth of this story, and there are so many stories that are undertold about this time frame that really share so much about our social history in addition to military history, and really informs how we're living today. So I really appreciate you coming on and sharing more of that and sharing your research, and we're of course going to share all of your resources. Is there anything else you would like to add before we say our final goodbye in the end?
I mean, just thank you for having me on. I think, you know, I hope that you share this story with other people if you find it interesting. Share it with young women. Get more women into STEM. Get more women into aviation. I hope that this inspired you to either learn more or to tell somebody else. These women are an important part of our history, and thank you for letting me share about them.
Of course, what a wonderful way to finish. And with that, we will say the end. You can learn more about Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast, by checking out our Instagram and TikTok at A Storytelling Podcast. You can also email us at astorytellingpodcast@gmail.com. Our music this season is Hopeful Start by John Bartman. Once Upon a Time, a Storytelling Podcast is a production of Talia Smith and Emily Joba. The end.